Oh, thank you. My name is Keith. I'm an alcoholic. So nice to be here. I really want to thank you for that very warm introduction, Roger. I don't know. I haven't felt that warm since my ex-wife threw me out. Really nice to be here. I want to thank Bob and Roger and the committee for asking Julia and I. I want to thank Julia for coming with me. We'll be married 2 years, a week from Monday. And it must be going pretty well because she's still coming places with me, so that's a real sign. It's just great being here. I can't tell you what it means. I've never been in Nevada before, and I've never been in Arizona, so this morning we walked across the bridge. And that'll mean a lot when I get back to the little group in Fayetteville, North Carolina, because they'll say, where were you? And I'll say, well, I was in Nevada and Arizona. And they'll be impressed. Most of the people in my group don't get out of town, except some of them do. And it was good to see Walt. Walt's taping this, and I saw Walt in San Diego about a month ago, and I mentioned to him that a lot of the men and women in my home group are in the Army. Fayetteville is the home of the 82nd Airborne and Special Forces, and a lot of them were in the Gulf. Almost all of them were in the Gulf, and a lot of the members of our group was on. And I mentioned to them that that we sent tapes to them. We would get speakers' tapes and send those, and then we would tape some of our meetings. It's a STEP study group, and we would tape some of our meetings and send those to them. And they had a regular network over there, and they just passed the tapes from person to person. And Walt sent me a box. I mean, a box of tapes. There must be 500 or 600 tapes of various speakers. And I really appreciate that, and I know my group does. And I hope I don't embarrass him, but there are an awful lot of nice folks in Alcoholics Anonymous who do a lot of nice things for people. And every once in a while, one of them gets caught. And Walt got caught. I'm an ex-Marine, so I won't be saying anything else nice about soldiers for the rest of the evening. You can... There are two of us. Any Catholics? I was born on a river, not as clean as this one. I was born on the Ohio River, but I bet you'd like to have it too. I know in California they want it, but we're not going to give it to them either. I'm from a family of 11 children. I'm Irish, and I'll let you guess what church I went to. I'm not going to tell you. I'll give you a hint. Bingo. And I grew up in this small town, like I said, on the Ohio River. The name of the town is Martins Ferry, Ohio. I don't know if you've ever been there. If you haven't, I wouldn't bother. It's just about canceled. And like I said, I grew up in a large family. And there was just so much I didn't understand about life. And I didn't know I didn't understand about life. You know, if you had found me in a bar some years ago and I'd have been drinking and you'd asked me about my life, I would have told you how tough it was. I would have told you that, you know, I grew up in poverty and that I had a father who never told me he loved me. And I was so impressed with what Richard was saying today about his father. And it reminded me so much of my father. I would have told you that my father never told me that he loved me. I would have told you that... That I went to a parochial school for 16 years and that I was taught by the Sisters of the Iron Glove of Nazareth, Kentucky, and that they used to beat me and all that stuff. And I'd have told you that I had so many brothers and sisters that I was never ever made to feel special. And I would have told you a lot of other things that weren't true also. Because, you see, I thought it was true, but I suffer from an illness called alcoholism that means my perspective's all wrong. You see, it's sort of a disease that from very, very early on made me feel different and alone and isolated. And I judged the world from that position of isolation, and frankly, I was wrong. Yeah, I was sober about 3 months, and there's some old-timers around the group I got sober in, and I'm sober in the Washington, D.C. area. And tomorrow they'll have a sobriety countdown, so you'll find there are probably some old-timers around here, too. And if you're kind of new, I'd like to caution you about old-timers. I'd kind of suggest you stay away from them, if you don't mind a suggestion. And I'll tell you why. It's because they're kind of strange. I don't know whether it's the cigarette smoke or coffee or something, but something happens to them, and they just get weird. And they'll tell you things that aren't true. Like, they'll say things like, well, I keep coming here because I have to, and I keep coming here so I don't drink. And that's just not the truth. They don't need to come here. The only reason they come here is to watch you and me suffer. That's the truth, that's right, and they're not doing much else, and they just like to tell us stuff that makes us suffer, and they really like to talk about not having sex and stuff, because they're not having any, and they don't want anybody else to have any either, and if you don't believe that, find one. You can pick them out in a crowd, and just go up to them and tell them a problem. And the first thing they do is laugh. They just involuntarily burst into laughter. And if you really want to get them going, tell them you're impotent. They like that one. They're impotent too. But I went up to this old-timer, and I belonged to a select group. We sort of had a group within the group when I got sober, and we were the problem of the month group. And we'd sit around and come up with a problem, and then it was somebody's job to go get an answer for this problem. And so I'd go to this old-timer, just like a fool, and I'd tell him his problem, and he'd just shake his head and laugh and have a good time. And he told me one time, he said, look, he said, I want you to do something. I said, what? And he said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls. He said, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls. And then he started laughing. He said, that's right, you can't. You're impotent. And he said, I want you to take that lipstick, and I want you to go home, and I want you to write on the mirror, Keith, you're wrong. I said to him, I said, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I have to be affirmed. I can't be putting myself down like that. And he said, Keith, I want you to borrow some lipstick. I said, all right. So I wasn't going to owe anybody anything, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home, and I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I threw the lipstick in a trash can, and I just disgusted. I knew they were crazy, and I went off to bed. And, it was sort of a normal night. Remember a normal night at 90 days? I closed my eyes, and my mind just kept going, and I was just obsessing. And, all those positive thoughts were going through my mind. You're never going to make it, and you'll be impotent the rest of your life. What difference does it make? Nobody wants you anyway, and just the usual stuff. And I drifted in and out of sleep, and my legs would cramp up, and I'd sit up in the middle of the night with a scream, and just the usual stuff. And I fell asleep 5 minutes before the clock went off, and the clock went off, and I opened my eyes, and depression jumped on me first thing in the morning, and I dragged out of bed, and that voice inside of my head was just going crazy, and it was saying things like, you're never going to make it. Today you're going to go to work, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do the job you've been doing for 7 years, and your kids are never going to love you, I went in and started coffee, and I just half in tears. It's just a normal morning, and I went in and looked in the mirror, and it said, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, thank God. If I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. And And that's when I found out that the great gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is how many things I've been wrong about. And I've been wrong about virtually everything in my life. And I always had a feeling that I had to be right. I don't know where I got this idea. It's an old idea. It was probably my old idea. At the time, I would have blamed it on a nun, but I don't think a nun ever told me this. But I sort of had the notion that that everybody's allowed so many mistakes, and I'd used up all but the last one. And I was going to make one more mistake, or I was going to be wrong one more time, and God was going to say, all right, get off the earth. That's it. You've used yours up. You're out of here, pal. You're history. And I knew that that was going to happen for me. Yeah, I had my first drink when I was 5 years old. I didn't drink alone. My father was with me, and my brother, Denny, old dumb Denny. Denny was 4 years old. Peculiar kid, but we were home alone. My dad was watching us, and we were sitting around the kitchen table, and my mom wasn't there. I don't know if she was either having a baby or at the bingo or something. And I guess Dad thought it might be kind of cute, and there were a few beers in the refrigerator, so he got them out, and he gave one to me and one to Dumb Denny, and he took one, and it's the strangest thing. You know, he gave us those little jelly glasses, you know, the kind with, you know, little cartoon characters on them, and mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant, but a psychologist would probably think so. You know, I drank my beer, and Dad drank his beer, and old Dumb Denny drank his beer, and I was fine. But I looked over, and old Ben had slid out of the chair down under the table. He was rolling around singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, and you know, Dad kind of panicked, and So he wrestled old Den to the ground, and he got his clothes off, and he put his jammies on him, you know, the kind with the feet and the trap door and everything. And he said to me, he said, son, get ready for bed. And I said, yes, sir. And I got up, and I got ready for bed. And Denny's carrying on and laughing and giggling and crying and everything. So Dad carried him upstairs and put him in his little crib. And my bed was across the room from his, and I went right to bed, and Dad says, don't say anything to your mother about this. I said, I won't say anything, Dad. He said, if you don't say anything to your mother, he said, I'll take you to the movies next week. I said, well, fine with me, Dad. I'm easy to get along with. But old Den wasn't hearing it. He's laughing and singing and carrying on. And then he finally, I'll never forget this. He stood up in his little bed, and he urinated on the floor. And I remember laying over there watching this disgusting display, and I said, you know, here's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, the strangest thing happened to old Denny. He just never made it. You know, the kind that just never quite make it. We're kind of ashamed of him, actually. Denny grew up, and I'll tell you some of the stuff he did. He really got weird. He went to one college. He had one major. Graduated on time. Went to one graduate school. Graduated on time. Looked around, he had these job offers from like 15 corporations. He went and he interviewed at all of them and everything. Picked one. Went to work for them 20 years ago. Vice president of a large international corporation. You know, the strangest thing of all, he married one woman. You know? Now you figure, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hand when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip away. I had to work at this stuff, man. You know, I was 22 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor. And this came hard to me. I also had something slept under my bed. Used to move around down here at night. You know, I don't know if they had any here. A lot of them in Ohio. And I knew what it was there for. It was there to get me. And And I knew what it was going to do. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. And I'd be gone. I mean, I'd just be history. And one morning, everybody would say, "Where's Keith?" And he'd say, "I don't know. He's gone. He was there last night, and he's gone." And they'd be sad. And I knew I'd never come back. And the reason I knew that was I was a little kid, and I used to listen a lot to little kids. I had a really bad speech impediment as a child, and I didn't talk much, and so I listened a lot. And I listened to all the little kids talk, and I never heard one of them say that that thing had gotten them and they came back. So I knew that if it got me, I was gone. But I also knew I couldn't talk about it, because I couldn't talk about things like that. So you had to keep all these unpleasant things a secret. And, you know, in the daytime, it was in the closet. And so I used to get my clothes out at night and stay away from the closet in the daytime. And, you know, my family thought I was colorblind because I could never get the right clothes out in the dark. Aside from that, I think I was a pretty normal kid. I'd have told you that that we were poor. You know, the truth of the matter was we just didn't have any money. You know, but we weren't poor. And I didn't know that till I found you. And you taught me that. You taught me I was wrong about that. Yeah, we didn't have a TV or anything, and we had to do strange things. Like, as a family, we had a reading hour. And we weren't permitted to read schoolwork. We had to read something just for the sheer enjoyment of it. And then we'd act out plays in the living room. And then the thing that I think is most special to me now is we had a prayer time together every evening. And we would say a rosary, or we would have a block rosary or something like that. And I thought I was poor. I didn't know how fabulously wealthy I really was. And I didn't know that till I met you. Because you showed me how wrong I was about absolutely everything. And then the nuns. Remember the nuns? You know, I started getting in trouble when I was in high school. And I didn't have a drink yet, other than when I drank with Denny. And I started getting in trouble. And I was thinking about that. You know, if we'd have had money, I'd have been an acting out adolescent. But we were poor, and I was just a punk. And I was getting into trouble on a pretty regular basis, and I had to serve detention. And we served detention in a library. And our librarian was an old nun. They're all old, but this one was even old for a nun. And her name was Sister Victoria, and she was a strange old bird. I'll never forget Victoria as long as I live. She used to parade around this library. And Julie and I went back some years ago and took a look at this high school that I went to. And this room was a tiny little room, and it didn't have very many books in it, and it had one magazine rack and that sort of thing. And I remembered how Sister Victoria used to strut around this library. And I realized that she knew that she was doing precisely what God wanted her to do. And to her, that library was like the Library of Congress. Because I've discovered since I've met people like you, the people who do God's will are happy wherever they are. And wherever they are and whatever they're doing is the most important thing there is. Because that's what God would have them do. And Sister Victoria lived like this. And she used to say strange things to us. She'd say things like, "Every boy is a prince, and every girl is a princess." We used to laugh at her. Behind her back, we'd call one another Prince Keith, Princess Mary, and we'd laugh at her. Yeah. And I used to serve a lot of detention, and you serve detention in a library with Sister Victoria. And she told me that I was a prince, but I was a contagious prince. So she used to put me behind the magazine rack. And back there, my job was to make rosary beads. See? And we got pliers and wire and these beads. And we make rosary beads. And for you heretics, those are things that... those are things that Catholics pray on, okay? And they come with 5 decades, 10 beads in each decade. And I made them with 11 seeds in each decade. And I did this for 3 years. And they'd take these rosary beads and they'd send them to the missions all over the world, you know. And, you know, in 3 years, I made hundreds, maybe thousands of mutant rosary beads. Yeah. And you know, this dumb nun never caught on. And so just before I graduated, I couldn't leave without her knowing. And so I sat down with her one time and I said, you know, sister, you know what I've been doing the last few years? And she started to laugh. She said, yes, you sly little prince. I know what you've been doing. She said, you've been putting 11 beads in all the decades of all the rosaries. And she said, furthermore, I know why you're doing it. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest notion why I do these things. And she said, it's so you know that people will pray all these extra prayers, and God's going to give you credit. And I wondered why I was doing that. And then she did something very strange, and she set me down, and she took both of my hands in her hands, and she looked at me and looked deep inside of me. You know how people do that, you know. People do it in AA, noxious people, you know, they look in your eyes and stuff, and she looked into my eyes, and she said, when I first met you, I knew you were special. You're a special child of God. And she said, you don't know that yet, but one day you will. And she said, when I first met you, I put this metal on my beads. And they used to wear these big beads, you know, hanging on their sides so they could bang them against the desk when you're taking tests. And she said, whenever I pray my beads and I get to this metal, it's a medal of St. Jude, who's a patron saint of lost causes. She said, whenever I get to this, I pray a special prayer for you, because one day God's going to send you all over the place to do His will. And I remember how that frightened me. And I remember how I got out of there as fast as I could. Because, you see, I didn't want to have a whole lot to do with God. Because I was sure God didn't want to have a whole lot to do with a guy like me. And, you know, I graduated from high school, and I took one of my very first inventories. I went home and I took my shirt off and I stood in front of the mirror and I really took a good look at myself and I sized myself up and I turned sideways and I looked and everything and I was 5 feet 1 inches tall and I weighed 113 pounds. I was a born killer. So I went and joined the Marine Corps and my poor mother just went crazy and I remember that night she's crying all night and she's saying, God, they'll kill him. They'll kill him. And my dad was saying, don't worry, Pat, they'll send him back. So that morning, next morning, they took me over and they put me on a bus. And I left Wheeling, West Virginia, and I drove to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to join the Marine Corps. And it was a very important day in my life. That's the day I had a spiritual awakening. Because, you see, it was a bad year, and the Marine Corps took everything that came. And I joined that day, and I was sworn in at 4 o'clock, and the train left at midnight. And there were three other guys from Pittsburgh, and so they said to me, they said, look, we're going to go over and have a sandwich and a beer. You want to come with us? And I figured, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And so I tagged along, and they took me over to a bar in Pittsburgh. And I don't know if anybody here has ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but let me tell you about it, man. Those places are filled with real men. You know, the kind with tattoos and they spit on the floor. I mean, they knew words of stuff I couldn't even imagine doing. And every one of them had a real woman with them. And real women hang around with real men and guys like me get what's left. And the bartender came over. He's a real man. And he said, what do you want? And my first thought was, oh, no, a quiz. I always had this feeling that when you least expected it, somebody in authority was going to say, take out a blank sheet of paper, put your name in the upper left-hand corner, and it was going to be a quiz, and I hadn't studied. I just felt that way about the world, and and I didn't know what to say, so I watched the other guys. And they all ordered a beer, so I did too. And then this guy came back, and he asked the same question. They gave him the same answer. And then he came back, and we ordered a third beer. And then it happened. Somewhere between the second and third drink, my life changed. And it changed dramatically. If you're alcoholic, you know precisely what I mean. I was standing there, sitting there, and all of a sudden I stood up. I don't even think I meant to stand up. I just stood up. You know? I don't think I could have kept from standing up. And I looked down, and the floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And I looked out here, and my right shoulder was out to here, and my left shoulder was out, and the muscles were rippling through my body. It's amazing. And then, you know, that mind, it had been so filled with fear and terror and everything. I didn't know anything about anything. The furthest I'd ever been from home was 100 miles. I went to Cleveland once, but the game was rained out. And I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps. I knew that they took guys down to South Carolina and drowned a certain number of them. That's all I knew. But now it's different. You know, that mind that was filled with fear and terror and doubt and everything was, boom, crystal clear. And you can only know what that's like if you've been confused and frightened. And I just stood there and I said, but of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? I mean, it just all fell together into this magnificently correct picture. Just a big picture for the first time in my life. And then I looked up. And my heart just broke. Because this place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snibbling little men. And all of them had women with them who were looking at me with those hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And they were saying, God, I'd give anything if I could have a man like that. And I went to take a step and I stumbled. And a guy said, what's the matter? I said, I don't know, but I think I just tripped over an invisible line. And I think that's true. I think that's the day I became an alcoholic. Now, I got a lot sicker than that. But I really don't believe I ever got any more alcoholic than that. And the reason I say that is because that's the day I discovered the great truth about me. And the great truth about me was I had been sober my whole life. And that's what the problem was. And I went on and I drank until the train left. And I went from table to table, and I filled these poor people in. They had a million questions, and I just told them everything I could. God, they didn't understand anything. And I explained to them about what it was like to be a real man, about the Marine Corps. I told them about politics. A few of them had some questions about sex. I filled them in. And they didn't want me to leave. It was sort of like when I left, they were saying, we've just found you. Can't you stay a day or two at least? And I said, no, I've got to go defend my country. And I got on a train, and then I woke up the next morning, and I was in Washington, D.C., which was 300 miles from my home, and that's three times as far as I'd ever been from home in my life. And I was on a floor of this Pullman coach, and someone had wet the floor of the Pullman coach, and whoever it was had wet me, too. And I felt awful. I felt like I weighed about 113 pounds, and I felt like I was about 5'1" tall, and my mind was filled with all that terror again and everything. And I got up and changed clothes and got off the train, and the guy said, look, we're going to go over to this place and have a few beers. You want to come? I said, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And so I went with him, and the same thing happened. You know, that night, I fell off the train in a little town called Yamasee, South Carolina. I didn't mean to fall, but somebody moved the bottom step, and I just fell, and I rolled across the railroad tracks, and there was a very rude man there who had come to greet all these guys who had come to die for their country, and they called him a drill instructor, and he was hurling obscenities at myself and these other young men, and I tried to reason with a cretin. I tried to tell him that if he treated us with a little respect, that he'd probably get a lot further with us. And so I was introduced to the United States Marine Corps. And the only thing I learned about that night was I could do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's the only thing I learned. And I went, I launched into my Marine Corps career. And I must tell you, I loved the Marine Corps. I really did. I kind of see, next to the nuns, it was easy. And I just really took to it like a duck to water. I loved everything about it. I liked the physical stuff. I liked the mind games. I just liked everything about it. And I did very well. I graduated Paris Island with Outstanding Man's Award and Dress Blues Award and all that stuff. And I made the decision that I was going to stay in the Marine Corps as long as they'd keep me. And I'd really found a home. And, 4 years later, I got out. And I'd worked hard and gotten all these meritorious promotions. And I'd won an appointment to Quantico to go to officers' candidate school. And you can't know what that means for a kid who grew up in the coal fields and the steel mills and everything. But I got out of the Marine Corps, and the reason I got out was because I was an alcoholic. And what I had done was violate the values of that fine organization. Oh, I'd never gotten caught. But that's what I'd done. I did the things you're not supposed to do. I drank on duty. I drank in a combat zone. I led a patrol in combat in a blackout. I don't remember going on it, and I don't remember coming back. And that was the story of my life. I mean, that's alcoholism. I just violated every value or every principle that ever meant anything to me. And that's all I can say about alcoholism. I just destroyed everything I touched because I couldn't live up to any value system. And it was sort of like alcoholism worked like this. It sort of said, okay, now what's most important to you? Let's violate that. And it was all the price of a drink. The last time I bought a case of beer, I was talking to a young fellow not long ago who we 12-stepped, and he was talking about how expensive drinking is. And he said to me, what did beer cost the last time you drank? And I said, the last case of beer I bought was a case of returnables, and it cost $3.27. And he said, why'd you stop? But the way my alcoholism was, it was sort of like this. I went in for a drink one day, and I went into a slop shooter. It went into the NCO club, and I said, give me a martini. And I said, how much is that? And they said, well, it's 35 cents in your Marine Corps career. I said, well, that's not too much. And so I paid it. And one day I went into a place, and I said, look, how about a fifth of that scotch over there? I said, what do I owe you? And they said, well, it's $6 and your marriage. Well, doesn't seem unreasonable to me. And I paid it. And then one day I went in and I said, how much is that wine over there? And they said, well, it's $2.50 and your two little girls. I thought, well, that doesn't seem unreasonable to me. And I paid it. And I think that's what alcoholism is. I think it's just that disease that makes you pay the last farthing. That's all. And I'd have paid whatever I had to pay because I didn't know that that's what I had. And nothing was unreasonable. And nothing was too much. And that's it. And, my alcoholism just isn't all that dramatic. All I did was violate anything that ever meant anything to me. I absolutely dirtied every place that I ever stood. And I dirtied it to such a point that I had to get away from there. About a month ago, well, it was Easter. We were in San Diego, Julie and I, and we were at the Al-Anon lunch, and somebody at the table said, they were talking about various places to go, and they said, Keith, what's your favorite place? I was surprised at my answer. I said, home. I'd rather be home than any place else. And it shocked me. And it's not because I live in a nice little house with a wonderful wife on a nice little golf course, and that isn't the reason. It isn't. It's because that's my home. And because I'm content where I am. Because I haven't had to dirty it up since I met you. That's why. I just hit bottom. That's all. My wife had thrown me out, and I wasn't permitted to see my children anymore, and just the usual stuff. And I was drinking alone in this dive in Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. I still had a job, but I wasn't getting to work very often. And then I did... went into that around-the-clock binge drinking. I'd call a liquor store and they'd deliver it. And I'd drink it. And I'd write out checks a few days in advance, and I'd buy the same thing so it cost the same, and I'd have the checks already, and I'd just hand it to them. And I didn't know if it was day or night. If they answered the phone, it was daytime, and I ordered it. If they didn't answer the phone, it was nighttime. And that's all I knew. And then, you know, one day, I just was finished. And, you know, suicide, you know, it wasn't a big thing. It was the next thing. You know, I guess the last bottle of wine was, you know, $2.50 in your life. And it wasn't too much. And then I woke up one day, and I can tell you what day it was. It was May the 13th, 1973. And I walked into what passed for a bathroom in this dive that I was living in. Not enough pills in there to kill me and two or three other people. And I think I began to take them. And to this day, I don't know if I began to take them or not. I just couldn't live anymore. And it's as though that was the value that I couldn't break. And I had another spiritual awakening. It wasn't unlike the first one. I was standing in front of that mirror and I said to myself, well, you're 29 years old and at least it will be over. And this voice said to me, when you're 29, it's not supposed to be over. It's supposed to be starting. And his voice was absolutely crystal clear. I can't tell you how clearly I heard that voice. And it startled me. And I knew that that couldn't be my voice, and I knew it couldn't come from me. It absolutely startled me. And I threw those pills down and I ran out. And somebody had given me two phone numbers, and it turned out to be my estranged wife. And I didn't remember that. And she told me later that she gave them to me. And what she said to me was, look, I can't do anything for you. Maybe these people can. And one number was Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was to a treatment center. There was only one treatment center in that town at that time. And I'd lost one number, so I called the other, and I happened to call the treatment center. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew something, and I told that lady, I said, if you can't help me, I think I'm going to die. And she got my name and phone number. Her name was Dorothy. And she said, honey, I'll call you back. And I hung up the phone, and I sat down on the floor and just began to cry. And the phone rang, and she said, you know, we can take you Wednesday. Can you stop drinking? And I said, well, I guess I can. I don't know. And I hung up the phone and I looked over, and on my draining board was a fifth of scotch. And God gave me something very special. And if you're kind of new, I'd suggest that maybe you take a little inventory tonight and look at what it is that God has for you that's special. You know, every one of us who enters recovery comes in here with something special that's just for us. You know, some people have a family that loves them, and you know, some people have a burning desire to get well. Some people may have a career that means something to them. Some people may have an active relationship with God. But everybody has something, and God gave me that special gift. I looked at that bottle, and I knew that if I took one more drink, I'd die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And that was my gift. You see, I worked in the hospitals and things, and I worked in a teaching hospital, and I frequently tried to scare myself sober or scare myself into drinking less. They used to post the autopsies in this hospital, and it was sort of like coming attractions. And you see somebody died from something you were interested in, you could go watch the autopsy. And whenever anybody died of chronic alcoholism, I'd go watch. And I watched them take that liver out and the brain, and I said, my God, you know, I'd watch as long as I could, and I'd run out of there and go down to Clyde's or Chadwick's or someplace, and I'd say, you'll never guess what I just saw. You better give me a triple. And they'd give me a triple, and I'd explain to the guys at the bar what I just saw, and they said, oh, my God, you better give us a triple, too. And then we'd sit there till 2 o'clock, and we'd discuss how anybody could have so little respect for themselves, and on and on. And so I knew that I couldn't be scared sober. I knew that that wouldn't work with me. But what God gave me was something different. He gave me the certain knowledge. If I took one more drink, I'd die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And I grabbed that bottle, and I ran over, and I started to pour it out, and I knew I wouldn't. And so I threw it in the sink, and it broke. And if it had bounced, I don't think I'd be here, because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. And if I take one more drink, I'll die, and knowing that will never keep me from taking it. Let me tell you how I see it. You know, May the 13th, 1973 is a very, very special date to me. And friends of mine got together one year and they gave me a little pennant that I sometimes wear around my neck that has that date on it. My lovely wife, Julia, has cross-stitched 3, 4, maybe 5,000 things with that date on it. And that's an important date because that's an important drink. I don't remember taking it, but it was sometime. But that's not the drink that's most important to me. You see, the drink that's most important to me is the drink I must take. See, I'm an alcoholic, and what that means is I must drink again. Unless there's a miracle. And that's where you come in. See, I kind of picture it like this. There's a drink out ahead of me. And you know, when I was brand new, if there's anybody here brand new, you know what I mean. You're sitting there saying, geez, I'd like to have a drink. God, and that drink's only 5, maybe 10 minutes away from you. You know, and you're saying no 5 minutes at a time. And you know, you hang around some of the sick old timers and, you know, some of them, you know, and eventually one day you'll recognize, as Keith did, described earlier today, you'll recognize that you went all day and you didn't want a drink. And you'll recognize that that drink is a day ahead of you. You'll begin to feel comfortable, and then, you know, you'll get involved in meetings and maybe picking up chairs or ashtrays or coffee cups or something. And you'll watch somebody come in who's got less time than you, and you'll get them a half a cup of coffee, and you'll tell them to keep coming back. You know, and then pretty soon that drink will get 2 days out there and 3 days out ahead of you, 4 days. And then pretty soon, as you work the steps and you work closely with your sponsor, you get that drink way out ahead of you, and you'll feel like $1 million. You'll just feel great. And then you'll do what most of us do. You'll try to get some balance in your life. I mean, after all, life is more than a bunch of meetings. Yeah. And you'll cut back, and you know, and you'll turn the phone off at night because you need your rest. And you know, you'll do that stuff, and then all of a sudden you'll start to feel bad, and you'll go to meetings and you'll listen to a bunch of dipshits who say the same thing at every meeting, and you know, and you'll arrive 10 minutes late, and at exactly the hour you'll be looking at your watch and saying, is she ever going to shut up? You know, and then pretty soon you'll be calling the shots. I mean, you'll be sitting there deciding who's going to make it and who isn't. Yeah, and you'll be right all the time, and you know what's happening is you're catching up with that drink. And let me tell you what'll happen to me if I ever catch up to that drink. I'll drink it. I will, because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. And what I know is if I ever catch up to that drink, I'll drink it. And you know, when I get like that, I go, oh, there's a problem here, there's a problem. So I run to my sponsor and say, there's a problem, what do you think it might be? And he said, well, I think there's too much balance in your life. He said, you know, you might want to act like a recovering alcoholic again. I said, well, you think it's that serious? He said, yeah, I think it's that serious. And then I'll throw myself back into this program, and I'll get on my knees, and I'll thank God for keeping me sober, and then that drink will get way out ahead of me again, and I'll get comfortable again. And I'll tell you my goal. You know, we can all have our own goals, and my goal is I'm going to live to be about 101. In the last year, I'm going to really clean it up. And in case Sister Victoria is right about purgatory and stuff. And then, you know, I'll die sober. And then 6 months, 9 months later, somebody will say, whose martini is that? And they'll say, oh, that's Keith's, but he died. You see, my goal is to die before I ever catch up to my drink. And I've seen people catch up to that drink. And I've seen them drink it. You know, I go to the hospital to visit them or something. And they'll say, I don't know what happened. And I know what happened. They caught up to their drink. And you know, we can be around other people's drinks. The big book says that. See, if we're spiritually fit. But you see, if I'm not spiritually fit, I'll gain on my drink. And if I ever catch up to my drink, I'll drink it. Because you see, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. And if I drink one drink, I'll die. And knowing I'll die will never keep me from taking it. See, that's where you come in. You know, that first year was wild. We had lunch today with a couple folks in the first year. And I was thinking about it this afternoon during my prayer time. And the first year is absolutely wild. I was frantic the first year. I just ran around like an absolute madman. But you know, after about 3 weeks, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know how that happened. One day I came back to this little treatment center, and I said to my roommate, Eddie, I said, you know, I'd do anything those people tell me to do. I want to be just like them. Brainwashed you. And I said, you really think so? Because if anybody's brain needs washing, it's mine. And Eddie said, yeah, I'm afraid they got you. I said, I'd love it if they'd get me. And Eddie worried about me. And I launched out to be like you. And I had a lot of old ideas. You know, one of the old ideas was that if God found out I wanted something, he took it away from me. If he found out I liked something, he took it away from me. And I believed that to be true. And I had some evidence to prove that, you see, because I had wanted to be married and she was gone. And I had wanted to raise two beautiful little girls and they were gone. And I wanted a career. And it was just hanging on a thread and it was all but gone. My mind was gone. I couldn't think anymore. And I knew that if God found out how much I wanted to be like you, you'd be gone too. So my job was to run around acting like I didn't want you. And I didn't want to be like you. And that's awful. It really is. You know, I'd arrive at the meeting 45 minutes early. I'd be so excited about getting there. I'd arrive 45 minutes early, and then I'd sit in my car across the street. And I'd watch you come in, and I'd watch you shake hands. Wasn't a lot of hugging back then, a lot of handshaking and stuff. And I'd see you greet one another, and my heart would just pound. I'd get so excited, you know. And then about 2 minutes before the meeting started, I'd stroll across the street, you know, with a cigarette in my mouth. And they'd say, how you doing? I said, all right. So how do you like it so far? It's okay. And inside I was saying, I love it, I love it, I love it. But I couldn't say that because if God found out how much I wanted it, he'd take it away from me. And you know, it wasn't until one day my first sponsor's name was Dan, and Dan would make me report down to the intergroup office, and Dan would answer the phone. I wasn't permitted to answer the phone. I was permitted, however, to get Dan's coffee when Dan answered the phone. And I'd just face back and forth, and I'd share with Dan how unfair it was. And Dan would talk to drunks on the phone. And he let me talk to one person on the phone. He let me give directions to a man from Connecticut to a meeting. And if that man's here, I want to tell you the directions were correct. The day was wrong. But the correct directions were correct, and if you'd have stuck around another day, the meeting would have been there. Now, that's done. I want to get that out of the way. But I was watching Dan, and Dan's talking to this lady on the phone who's drunk, and she's inviting him over to spend the night. And Dan's saying things like, no, ma'am, we don't do it that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, what I will do, though, is I'll have a couple ladies come over and talk to you about this program. No, ma'am, I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with you. No, I'm not. And I was watching him do this. And something happened inside of me. You know, I didn't realize anything about unconditional love. I didn't realize anything about anonymity being the spiritual basis of this program and this fellowship. Here's a man who's loving a woman who's drunk, and he's doing it anonymously. She would never know who he was. And I didn't understand that, you see, because I grew up in a world of shortages. There's only so much credit, and if you got some, I got less. There's only so much praise, and if you got some, there was less for me. You know, if my children loved you, they had to love me less. And here's a man loving somebody anonymously. And something happened inside of me, and I just burst into tears. And he hung up the phone and looked at me, and he said, what's the matter, my friend? And I said, you don't seem to understand. I said, you people are beautiful. I said, you're the greatest people I've ever seen in my life. I love you. And he started laughing and he said, well, he said, I love you too. And he said, if we're great people, you're great too because you're one of us. And that's the first day I really felt like I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't sleep. You know, and I go to meetings. And somebody say at the end of the meeting, they'd never asked at the beginning of the meeting because they had a topic they wanted to discuss. But at the end of the meeting, they'd say, before we close, does anybody here have a problem? See, AA meetings never used to be like big therapy sessions. But at the very end, they'd say, anybody here have a problem? If you had a problem, they'd say, talk to your sponsor. And they'd say, if you said, I don't have a sponsor, they'd say, that's the problem. At the end of every meeting, I'd put my head up. They'd say, yes, Keith, what is it? I said, I can't sleep. And they'd say, you know, the pat line, somewhere in a big book, nobody ever died from not sleeping. One night I jumped up and screamed, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. One night I went down to the Jefferson Memorial. At night when I couldn't sleep, I'd just drive around town. Look at the monuments. And one night I drove down to the Jefferson Memorial, and I was looking around, reading all the stuff that Tommy wrote, and I went out and laid down in the grass, and strange thing happened, I fell asleep. And I woke up about an hour later, and I was as excited as I could be. I said, you know, the problem isn't you can't sleep. The problem is you've been sleeping in the wrong place. And I ran up home, and I got a sleeping bag, and I brought it back down, and I laid it out, and I laid down and went right to sleep. It's amazing. And about an hour later, somebody's kicking my foot. And I woke up, and it was a park policeman. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'll tell you what I'm doing. And I told him my story. And he said, no shit. You mean this is the only place you can sleep? I said, this is the only place I can sleep. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, you need to sleep. You come on down here and you sleep. He said, just don't drink. I said, I won't. You know? So every few days when I couldn't sleep, I'd get my sleeping bag and I'd go down to Jefferson Memorial. I'd lay it out there and I'd lay down and look at the stars. And I hear somebody say, Keith, is that you? I said, yeah. He'd say, how many days? I said, 63 days. He said, isn't that wonderful? He said, you want some coffee? I said, no, I better get some sleep. And he said, don't worry. He said, we'll keep an eye on you. See, I was wrong about the police. And you know, my father, who never told me he loved me, you know, not too long ago. And I was graduated from Paris Island. Like I say, I won all this stuff. And my father took a bus from Ohio to South Carolina. And he wore the only suit he owned, which was a wool suit. It was in the middle of the summer and it was hot as blazes. You know, and I never forget him. And he's standing there in this wool suit, just perspiring and everything. And they took our picture with the colonel and me getting all these awards and everything. And we're walking across the drill field. And he said to me, do you realize if you put this much effort into college, you'd be a straight-A student? And my bubble just burst. And I was so disappointed because I knew he didn't like what I had done. And he didn't think it was important. You know, I believed that until 2 years ago. And about 6 years ago, my mom and dad moved down. I have a little house on the ocean, a place called Carolina Beach. If you're ever down there, it's on Carolina Avenue South. And there's a little sign that says, CZ does it. And stop for coffee. But my folks were down there for a little while, and we went down to visit them before they moved back to Ohio. And dad started talking about when I graduated from Paris Island. And he said to me, he said, I always knew that because Patty was in college and Denny was going off to college, I always knew that you probably felt like what you were doing wasn't as good. And he said, so I wanted you to know that what you had done was as good as straight A's in college. You know, I never heard it that way. You know, I was wrong about my father. My father shouted, I love you. He told me something else that was important to me. You know, I would have told you that I had to go to work when I was 13 years old, and the first job I had was to set pins in a bowling alley. And my father and I sat down and talked about that day. And he said to me, do you remember that day you went to work down at Jimmy Lamont's bowling alley? I said, yeah, I remember. And he said, remember what we did? And I thought for a little while, and I said, yeah, Dad. We went down to Louis' hot dog stand, and you bought me a hot dog and a root beer. And we talked. And I do remember, he talked to me about what it was like to go to work. And he told me, he said, you know, son, you do a good day's work and you get a good day's wage. And you owe the man you work for respect. Remember that. You owe him respect. And he owes you respect. And then he said, we walked down. And he said, remember what happened? And I said, yeah, I took a bus down to the next town, down to Bridgeport. And he said, you know, he said, I stood there and I said to you, son, do you want me to go with you on the first day? And you said, no, Dad, I'll take care of it myself. And he said, I watched my small, frail 13-year-old son get on a bus and never look back. I can't imagine what it would be like to let a 13-year-old child go. He said, from that day on, I never felt as though I could ever give you anything. He said, your brothers and sisters let me help them through college and everything. And he said, you went and got scholarships, and you never, ever let me help you. I never let him be my father. The ninth step is absolutely correct. He treated me the only way I allowed him to treat me. I was wrong about my father. And I was wrong about God. And you know, I put God on the top of my eight-step list. And one day, I put on a three-piece suit. And I went to a chapel. And I sat down and I talked to God. And I made amends to God. Oh, I did it my way, but you know, I said, remember me, you know, the guy used to serve Mass at 5:45 when nobody else wanted to come and serve Mass. And you always rely on me, remember that. Never drank the wine like all my friends in AA. And then I talked to God, and I said, you know, I've been away, Father. And I've been away, and I've been denying it all. And I've been wrong. I'm glad I'm wrong about you. And then I started to think about how wrong I'd been about religious people. You know, I laughed at them and ridiculed them, made fun of them. And one day I went down to a little retreat house in Faulkner, Maryland, a Jesuit retreat house. And I went down there to find a religious person to make amends to. And, you know, I was one of those members of AA who was religiously anti-religious. And I'd really ridiculed you people who have a working relationship with God. And I called you silly. I went back and got a degree in theology to prove you were wrong. And I wanted to find somebody to talk to. And I was looking for this young theologian down there. He was hep, and I knew he would understand the deep significance of this magnificently humble act I was about to perform. And I could never find him. But instead, there was an old priest sitting in this room. And he was in a rocking chair. And he had a blanket across his lap. And he was sitting there reading his breviary, his little Bible, and rocking back and forth. And it suddenly occurred to me that maybe God wanted me to talk to him. And his name was Jim. And I knocked on a door and I said, Father Jim, could I talk to you a few minutes? He said, of course, son, come in. And came in and he pulled up a rocking chair and I sat there and rocked. And he rocked and we talked. And I told him about me. I told him about how angry I'd been at people like him and how frightened I'd been and how I'd criticized and judged people like him. People who just showed up. People like Sister Victoria, who looked at me and saw a prince. And I went on to tell him where I'd been and what I'd done. And I got about halfway through, and this saintly man put down his Bible, and he got up, and he pulled me out of the chair, and he put his arms around me. And he just began to rock me. And he said, stop it, son. He said, it's not you who owe me an amends, it's I who owe you one. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years, and I have cancer, and I don't think I have long left. He said, and I was just sitting here asking God, as I understand him, what have I missed? Where have I gone wrong? Is there anything that I need to make right? And he said, it suddenly occurred to me that too many times in my life, I'd forgotten what my higher power told me to do. He told me to forget the 99 who agreed with me and to go out and find the one who was lost. He said, I'm sorry, you were out there all alone. And I began to understand something about the magnificence of this program. I began to understand that these steps aren't my steps. These steps aren't even our steps. These steps heal the world. You know, I did go through life like a tornado, and I did wreak havoc. But you know, since I met you, I've been able to change that. And I've actually been able to do a little good along the way. I have been wrong about absolutely everything. I was wrong about marriage. You know, I was just lousy at it. I was just lousy at relationships. You know, I'd never, ever been faithful to a relationship ever in my life. I hadn't. I don't just mean interpersonal relationship. I mean any relationship. I could have a job that I loved, and I'd look into one ads every morning. Because I knew it was just a matter of time till that was gone. God would find out I liked it, and it'd be gone. And it was like that with absolutely everything. And that's why I never had a place. My sponsor now is a man named Tom Ives from Aberdeen, North Carolina, which is about 25 minutes. And this Monday evening, he'll come over to the little group of Alcoholics Anonymous, because Monday I'll be celebrating my 13th AA birthday. And Tom comes over once a year and talks to us. It's normally a step discussion group, but that once a year he comes over and talks to us. And my plane doesn't get into 5:40, so God willing, I'll be there. But I heard Tom talk some years ago when I had moved to North Carolina, and he said something that impressed me very much. He said, "I'm a citizen of the town of Aberdeen, North Carolina." And I went home and I thought about that. And I was amazed at that, that anybody would be a citizen any place, and that they would belong any place. And that day I made up my mind that I was going to try to belong. And you know, I belong. I'm a citizen of Fayetteville, North Carolina. I live in a little house on a 10th green and a nice little golf course. I vote. I mean, I vote even if I don't understand the issues. I vote. Because I'd rather vote than be wrong than not vote. I just feel that way because, you see, I'm a citizen. See, and I have a library card. Now, I never check any books out of the library, but I got it. And if you don't believe me, I'll show it to you. You come up after the meeting, I'll show you my library card. I belong there. I really do. That's my home. And you know, when we get a chance, we get in a car and we take a nice 2-hour drive through the country, and we have a little house down on the ocean, and we go down there, and then I go to the group down at Carolina Beach, and down to Fort Fisher under the trees. We have an 11-step meeting on Sunday morning, and I can go to Mass and get out of Mass and beat it down there, and I just belong. And I married a woman who I love very, very much, and we belong together. She's my wife, and I'm her husband. And she loves me. She really does. And you know, all my life I tried to be something or to be somebody so I could be loved. And I did everything you could do. After I got sober and I quit smoking, I started running marathons. You know, I had this heart that only beat a few times a minute. This big, strong heart that was pumping blood to all my arthritic joints. And I went back to school and I got a couple degrees, and I did all these things so that I could be somebody, so I could be good enough so that somebody could love me. And you know, every once in a while I look back at our wedding pictures and I have to laugh. You know, I look at this guy who's heavier than he's ever been, you know, has fewer teeth he can call his own than he's ever had before, more gray hair than he's ever had before, and never, ever loved as much as he was that day. I don't understand how life works. I never have, and I probably never will. The only thing I have is you to teach me. And you're everything in the world to me. You know, my roommate Eddie, that guy in that treatment center who didn't want to be brainwashed. You know, the first year I was sober, after 6 months, I was thinking, and Richard was talking today, after 6 months, I was given the opportunity to go to Paris to study with the world's greatest psychologist. And he asked me to come over and study. And I spent a little bit of time there and went to AA meetings there. And then I left there and I went to Rome. I took the Palatine Express across the Alps to Rome. And I lived in a monastery just because I wanted to. Because it's something that I always wanted to do. And I was what they called familiares. And that means I could take part in anything I wanted to take part in. I got up early in the morning with the monks and I prayed and I did all that stuff. But I also got out into the only AA meeting in Rome at the time on 13 Via Napoli, and I met a lot of drunks from the States and from England and from Australia. And then I came back and I just lived a life that was a million miles from that day when I nearly committed suicide. A million miles. And yet, my friend Eddie came when I celebrated my first AA birthday. And Eddie had been drunk a few times that year, and he had a patch on one eye, because the third time he got drunk, he ended up in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and somebody had gouged his eye out with an ice pick. And my sponsor, Dan, got up, and he said, "You know, Keith's done everything wrong this year, except he's gone to AA 500 AA meetings, and he hasn't taken a drink. But he's done everything else wrong." You know, when the meeting was over, Eddie ran up to me and he shook my hand and he said, "I'm really happy for you." He said, "I know you like this stuff and I'm really happy for you." I said, "Thank you, Eddie." I said, "Thanks for coming." And he said, "Yeah, I didn't want to come, but I came because we're buddies." And I said, "I know that and I love you for it." And he said, "But don't you think you're overdoing it with the meetings?" You know, it was so sad. And I wasn't trying to be smart, and I wasn't trying to hurt Eddie, but I said to him, you know, Eddie, one of us got one eye and one of us got two eyes. Because I didn't know how else to explain the difference between having you in my life and not having you in my life. It's been incredible. It's been a thing that I never thought could ever happen to me. You know, I've worked these steps with your help, and do you know I can walk around any corner in the world and not be afraid of who I'm going to run into? You know, I could die tonight, and I know that my higher power would be waiting to accept me into the kingdom. I know that. And I get to talk with Sister Victoria and Father Jim and a lot of them, you know. And then I'll be a prince. And Sister Victoria's a princess. You know, I moved to Fayetteville in 1980. And I had a little apartment then overlooking a lake. And there have been times in my life when I've just been overwhelmed with the magnificence of you. And I was sitting there this day, and I was praying, and I was reading a big book, the big book. And I said to God, I said, Father, you know, why me? Why have you picked me? And I just began to cry. So why am I sober? Why do I know you? Why do I have this relationship? And I just sat there and cried. And I remember the time 8 years before when I was in that treatment center. And I called this poor woman who had gone through my alcoholism and who had thrown me out, and that's how I got well. And when I was in that treatment center, and I'd been there about 2 weeks, I really discovered I was an alcoholic. And I called her up and I said, it's me. And she said, what do you want? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, no shit. And I said, why me? She said, why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do. And she hung up. Yeah. And that day I said to God, Father, why me? And he said, why not, son? If anybody deserves it, you do. And that's the beauty of this, you see. You see, I deserve it. Not because of who I am, but because of who he is. That's what he always had for me. He always wanted me to live the 12 steps. He always did. But you see, I have this disease, it's spiritual in nature. And I went on a trip. And I went away. And then you found me. And you brought me back. And I thank you.